Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Thank you all for making it.
We're going to be the number one media conglomerate in the world.
The key here is act like a happy family.
We're the Osmonds, and I'm Daddy fucking Warbucks, okay?
I always wanted one of you kids to take over.
People would do well to remember there's going to be a new sheriff in town.
Here's to us.
Welcome back to Still Watching Succession, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Succession. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us for the first time, what we do every week on Still Watching is we break down the latest episode of our current, like, sort of TV obsession. Right now we are in the midst, in right smack dab in the middle of Succession on HBO. We are talking about season 2, episode 5, Turnhaven, which is When the Roys Met the Pierces. Great episode of television. So we will be talking all about that, but spoiling nothing beyond that because we haven't seen it. So there you go.
I love when this show just like knows what we want. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you hear about this, oh, the Pierce family, it's like, oh, that'd be kind of interesting to meet the Pierce family. It's like, they're like, don't worry. There's going to be a whole episode where they go to another mansion and meet the other people. Like,
and it's not just one.
Yeah, who are weird and like bad in their own way. Like, I just, like, it's very, it's just very satisfying.
It's great. It's perfect. I cringed a lot because I recognize maybe a little bit of myself, but definitely people I grew up with. I don't recognize people I grew up with in the Roys, but I do with the Pierces. So
sure.
Here we go. The like Shakespeare quoting, Pierces. So what we've been doing the last couple episodes is sort of running down our power players, in the episode and sort of seeing who's on top, who's on the bottom. We love starting the top and ending on the bottom because it's fun to end with the losers. And this week we've got some Pierces in the mix. With the Roys, as we mentioned. Before we get to that, though, I did want to read a quick email from a listener. You can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we would love to hear your thoughts on all of this. We got a couple emails. I'm just going to conflate a couple emails. We got an email from Juliana and an email from Catherine about the character of Gil. Catherine was interested in a shot in episode 2 of the season where Gil is pulling Shiv aside to talk to her about becoming chief of staff. And he puts his hand near her shoulder, but ultimately lands on the small of her back. Shiv doesn't seem to clock this, but the camera definitely does. And then Juliana writes in about what she calls Shiv's breakup, where I think Juliana's just responding to what we were, which is like Shiv sort of cutting ties with Gil, who's this Bernie Sanders-esque figure, right, that she was working for, seemed very, like, clumsily, weirdly done. And Juliana points out that it was done in front of Nate, so she's like, maybe this is, like, some weird long play from Shiv. I don't think it is. I think this episode really proves to us, you know, when we see Shiv say, like, I really want this to Tom, like, it proves us that the reason that she left Gil is because, like, her offer, her father made her an offer she couldn't refuse, right? An offer she believed. So I don't know that she's, like, playing any kind of long game with Gil, or necessarily if Gil is trying to be depicted as any kind of, like, sexual harasser by the, where his hand was and stuff like that. That being said, I've been saying all along, I really feel like this presidential campaign is going to keep cooking. Obviously, we've got Connor talking a lot of politics in this episode. So I can't imagine it's the last we see of Gil. My ideal, right, is that we get Gil versus Connor. Like, that seems to be, like, a fun thing. And so I think any information we want to sort of, tuck away for future about Gil that could explode on him. So maybe that hand, moving to the small of her back is a sort of Biden-esque, though it didn't hurt Biden, thing to watch out for, you know, for the future of Gil's campaign. Who knows? But, I deeply suspect it's not the last we've seen of him. So there you go.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
All right, so away from the politics and back to the business. We are sad to report that once again, Logan Roy is at the top of our list.
Yeah.
Because as he says at the end of the episode, money wins.
Yeah.
He gets everything he wants. He does not have to, like, accede to any of Nan's requests. And, he fucks over his daughter, in the process, it feels like. So, I think there's no better example of Logan's power as when, Siobhan sort of, like, tears in her eyes, unshed tears in her eyes in the helicopter at the end is like, what happened? And he just literally goes, like, doesn't bother to articulate a single word, to her. So
yeah,
there you go. Logan Roy.
How many times in your week, let's say your average week, do you get to yell at somebody, fly your fucking whirlybird? I mean, that won him the episode for me. Just that one line.
It's true. I was wondering if that's, do Americans ever call it a whirlybird, or is that like a Scottishism, I mean, or a Britishism? I've heard it. I just like.
I think it, as a sort of joke. Yeah. Like an old timey kind of joke. I don't think people like sincere. They're like, oh, I have a, you know, 6 p.m. whirlybird to JFK.
One thing that I love that I read in the Hollywood Reporter piece that they did before the season started is, you know, they have all these consultants on the show, and basically there are consultants, who like tell them how to be rich, how to act rich. Right. And one detail that I love that Kieran Culkin, noted is that they were instructed not to ever duck their heads when they get in and out of a helicopter, because like they've been stepping on and off helicopters their whole lives. And so they're not like, they're used to it, and they're not like, I would be like, basically crawling towards a helicopter if I had to get on like under like whirling blades. But people who are accustomed to it would just be like, yeah, that's the blades of the helicopter. It's fine.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking about that, watching them all kind of at the helipad on the East River. Like, I was just like, well, actors do so many crazy things. Like, they're just like riding in helicopters all the time, or at least stepping onto helicopters, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a really interesting detail. I like that.
There's also like, you know, in Logan's favor, there's that speech he sort of gives, when they're at the cocktail hour, where he goes, I ain't no master of speechifying, and he calls himself Romans amongst you Greeks. And, it's so smart. Like, the way, like, it doesn't, he doesn't maintain that performance all the way through, but like even Connor is like, who's this dad? I wish this dad were our dad. You know what I mean? Like that he's speaking their language, which he's like, oh, you rich assholes like the classics. All right, we can do this. He's speaking their language and he's, you know, aw shucksin, like basically his way towards a win. That mask slips and he still gets what he wants, but it's interesting to see him sort of try it on for a little while. So.
Yeah. And also like, what was the power dynamic in history in terms of like Romans and Greeks? Like, you know, the Romans, you know, came after the Greeks. They stole their gods, renamed them, built an empire. You know, like, I think he's also being like, you know, just so you know, you guys are kind of going the way of the dodo. I am the conqueror. And yes, I maybe not be as like erudite or whatever. I'm maybe a little crasser, a little more boorish, but like, I'm still the fucking Romans.
Yeah, absolutely. We get, we don't have, spoiler, we don't have Marsha on our list. Maybe we should, but we should probably talk about Marsha, in this episode in the context of Logan, I suppose, which is, her little rebellions that she's sort of, not to infantilize them, but like, you know, he instructs everyone not to drink that much. She's like, no, I'm going to have as much wine as I want. Thank you very much. And, I like the way that Nan likes, you know, and she's like, if you have a whole year, I couldn't tell you my life and all the sort of stuff like that. And I like how Nan is like really impressed by her and all of that. And I just feel like Marsha was watching the Shiv thing and watching all of this and sort of Marsha is always operating on something at some level, you know, so.
Yeah, I thought it was, part of me was like, I don't really know where this came from with her characterization. Like, why would she be acting out like this? It's such a crucial thing. But like, I also kind of did get it. Like, you know, they have that kind of private exchange in the room where she's like, well, I'm glad that I like got a good grade along with all the other students or whatever it was, you know, like, and I can understand like her being thrown into that kind of deal making context and she's treated as this kind of, you know, arm of Logan and not an actual person, like, yeah, why she would maybe take to the bottle and speak her piece.
Well, I think she sniffs the Shiv thing because you cannot get anything past Marsha is the point, right?
Right.
And so in the earlier episode when like Shiv comes over and Marsha's trying to like be in on the conversation and Logan sends her away, like I think she sniffs the Shiv thing. And even though the Shiv thing seems to explode in this episode, that is something that Marsha has like a very close eye on. And they said, you know, sexist as it may be, they set up that dynamic in the first season where like Shiv and Marsha specifically are sort of like coming to blows. And I think one of the things that they're referencing, I can't remember if I talked about this in the podcast already, but the whole like, Redstone family thing and how, Sherry Redstone, Sumner Redstone's daughter basically like, kicked his girlfriends out of the house. It was like this whole thing between his daughter, this media mogul's daughter, and his girlfriends. And like Marsha is not like some, and he was living with like multiple girlfriends and they seemed very like gold dicky. Marsha does not seem, she's not in that power position, but that conflict between daughter and stepmother, you know, and Marsha like called Shiv an ungrateful bitch, something awful last season. So like, I don't know, it's a very, that particular dynamic is one to sort of keep an eye on, I think. So
for sure, yeah,
there you go. All right, number two, rocketing up the charts is Kendall Roy. Kendall got a big win this week, and the way he got it, I feel like, was just being himself. Which is kind of...
Yeah, just be yourself, guys. Just do as much Coke as you need. Drink however much Grey Goose as you need. And then shit in whatever bed you want.
But, I mean, what's true is when, like, Naomi's the key to bringing Nan around. Kendall seemed to convince Naomi. And one of my favorite shot of the episode is when they're in that final meeting with Rhea, Shiv, Nan, and Jerry, and Logan, and Kendall, and... Nan says something about like, you know, well, Naomi had a talk with me and blah, blah. And the camera's just on Kendall and he doesn't even really look up. He just has like a slight smile. And like, well, it's possible that he was somewhat manipulating Naomi when he was talking about, like, think of this as your ticket out. This is a good for you. You can just get out. While he's like slightly working her in that context, they also seem to genuinely have this addiction connection, that doesn't feel completely put on. So I don't know. It's a good episode for Kendall.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the way that, like, seemingly Naomi, you know, has, what is it? Her aunt, I guess, would it be? Nan's ear.
Yeah.
You know, though she is this kind of penitent, you know, trying to clean up her act kind of person. I mean, that's so similar to Kendall and his father. So, yeah, I think same saw same. And, like, I think that is kind of the, I don't know, I guess the sort of logic of this show and these characters is use what you have. And perversely, that, you know, quote unquote brokenness, or certainly not that being an addict is to be a broken person at all, but, you know, that trial, that hardship, that predilection, I guess, you know, strangely can be used, I suppose, as an asset, if you are willing to, you know, follow it down that path.
Yeah, it's, I really love this, new character of Naomi Pierce, who we met sort of, she's the person who Roman tried to call in an earlier episode. She's friends with Tabitha, his girlfriend, non-sexual partner, Tabitha, played by Annabelle Dexter Jones, who's great. I think she's fantastic in this part. But this idea that she sort of recognized, saw immediately who Kendall was when he walked in is something powerful. I really liked the Kendall, Rhea dynamic in the first season, his ex-wife, but it is always this sort of, like, for him, this, like, coming, apologizing, hat in hand sort of dynamic with, like, he's fucked up so irrevocably with Rhea, with his kids, that he's just constantly on the back foot. And this idea that he, you know, maybe not happily ever after, but, you know, for now, for a few episodes, for whatever, he has found this, like, kindred in this other person is a really fun thing for the writers to have done.
Yeah, I wonder if she'll come back. I hope so, because I'm intrigued.
I feel like she will. And once again, this is no spoilers. My concern, I'll tell you my concern, and then I'll tell you why I'm not concerned about my concern. My concern is that Naomi is the kind of character where she shows up and she and Kendall have this connection and it's this whole thing, and then she, like, ODs.
She's Kristen Ritter on Breaking Bad.
Exactly what I thought. And then Kendall learns a lesson of some kind. So that's what a TV show might do with this character. I hope and think that Succession is not going to do that with this character is because what another TV show might do also is, like, have Kendall, like, crash that helicopter because it would be, like, funny and a spectacle and whatever and, oh my God, how crazy. And they can, like, blame it on something else. But they were like, no, like, let's have the danger of that, right? Like, he's turning on, you're like, what the fuck are these high drunk fucks going to do? Like, what are they going to do here? And then they, like, don't. And that's, yeah, he literally shits the bed, but, like, it could have been much, much hackier and worse. You know what I mean? So I really liked it. I got to shout out Jeremy Strong as Kendall, his reaction when, Naomi reads hers, gives her a bit of Shakespeare and he goes, that was awesome.
Like, yeah. Genuine.
So dumb. Like, he's genuine, but also just sort of like, she says this, like, beautiful piece of Shakespeare. He's like, that was awesome. Like, way to go, bro. All right. Number 3 on the list, is our girl, Jerry. Richard, do you want to say why Jerry deserves the number 3 slot on our list?
Well, I guess, suppose because she's further developed her, you know, sort of, let's say unconventional, relationship with Roman, which is interesting. I think it's a real coup for, you know, in a metatextual sense, Jerry's character, you know, it's like, oh, cool. Like, look, she's getting interesting new things to do. So I think that's good. But, you know, she was brought into that final meeting with Nan. Like, she is still firmly at the center of all of this, even if she's playing a sort of quieter, seemingly more passive role.
Yeah. And I just really like, we got a little bit of a hint of a smile from her in last week's episode when she had this call with Roman, but that we get to see more of, like, how this is sort of fun for her, you know, yeah, like totally. Intriguing and curious and fun and exciting. So I'm really into Jerry enjoying herself, in all of this. And what seems clear from the context of this episode is that she and Roman have been like having these calls ongoing. I think he was away. His training is supposed to be 6 weeks. I don't know if he's like done the whole training. I think he has. So like that they've been doing this for 6 weeks, is longer than a lot of my relationships at last day. No, I'm like, it's interesting. So there we go.
Jerry, yeah. And how satisfying it must be to have one of the Roys want you to tell them what a piece of shit they are.
Yes. She can just like unleash all the things she's, pent up for years. All right. Number four is a shared spot for Rhea Jarrell and Nan Pierce. The amazing Cherry Jones. I just like, this is just, perfect.
The costuming, the hair. Yes. What does she say? Thank you for coming to our weird little home. And it's this like palace, but that waspy old Northeastern money way of like, oh, this old pile of brick, you know, whatever, you know,
driving the old
Volvo. Like there's an old, Jeep Wagoneer we see in one shot in this episode. Like it's just, it's a very, as someone who has passed by that sort of not quite that extreme wealth, but like sort of Northeastern New England wealth, like, it's a very well observed, caricature.
It's perfect. My favorite, aspect of Nan is her relationship with her staff, right? So she, there's this character of Rosa, who I think is like the main housekeeper or what have you. And she's like, Rosa, have a drink with us. Oh, come on. You never treat yourself. Like I'm so liberal and progressive that I treat my housekeeper like she's my, who works you so hard? Like, you know, put your feet up. You deserve it or whatever. But then mirrored with that great scene where like you see Rosa and her staff slaving away in the kitchen, and then Nan like brings the roast out and gets the applause, and Rosa's just sort of like standing in the background watching.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's a beautiful portrait of someone who like is gonna take all the credit. I don't know. It's just, it's
of a really fraught relationship that people, you know, with people who have, you know, domestic workers, essentially like, oh, you know, like she's part of the family, but she's not, you know, like it's a really interesting, dynamic that I think, you know, something like Roma explored, really well. You know, and I like that there were shots of Rosa throughout the episode, like little quick things of her just kind of observing or like turning her head and watching something happen as she's like, you know, carrying some laundry or whatever. Like I thought that was nice. And it made me think of the Cherry Orchard, and how that play, you know, set in this old, you know, Russian villa out in the country, as basically one period of Russia, you know, ends and another begins seemingly in a more populist sort of, you know, collectivist way. And the family leaves, they have to sell the house, and the last person on stage is Fears, the old butler, who everyone forgot to bring with them. And he's just like there alone in the house as they, you know, board up the windows and everything. It's a beautiful play and a beautiful moment, but it just kind of, I feel like there was a little nod to that in this episode with the kind of constant shots of Rosa.
I love that. That's a very Pearson observation of yours.
Theater degree is finally coming to use.
So this whole, and then for Nan Pierce, say something like, money is a social construct, like integrity is what matters, something like that. You're like, oh, come on, Nan. Like, let's, all right. So I just, you know, the kind of, and I say this as someone who came from like, well, okay, what unnerves me in Succession is whenever they mention where I grew up, which is Marin County, California, which is an extremely rich part of our country. Naomi flew out from Mill Valley. That's where I grew up in Marin County, in California. And they've also mentioned Sausalito. They just keep mentioning Marin, like as obviously like someone in the writer's room is either from there or just like knows that like, let's keep going back to this one section of the country as this embodiment of, like, West Coast liberal wealth, I guess, is sort of like a thing. Like we're really progressive. Like we're right across the bay from Berkeley. Like we get it. We like, we believe in progressive politics, but like Rosa doesn't get to bring the roast to the table. So like, that's just all part of it. And then Rhea gets exactly what she wants, which is, this deal. She wants this deal. She wants the money from this deal. While playing this part where she plays this part of like, really getting her hits in on, ATN, on Waystar Royko, and like on their politics. And to the very end, she's like pushing the financials and stuff like that. But she plays it all perfectly. Also, Holly Hunter is styled exactly like my mother in this episode. So it's creeping me out. But, you know, it's a perfect sort of, another portrait of another kind of player in all of this. You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's such an interesting dynamic in this episode with Rhea and Nan, who represent, you know, nominally, you know, our side of things, the sort of more, you know, progressive and, you know, they hate all this kind of Fox News stand-in thing. But we saw last week, when we first met Rhea, that she's sort of amused by the, you know, the Roman-ness of the Roy family. And I think, I don't think Nan is as amused by it, but, clearly they're not, she's not so repulsed that she won't work with them, or sell her company to them. She's kind of choosing to trust them, like that they won't, you know, ruin her legacy, her family legacy, which is interesting. And I think that it's interesting that the way the episode is written and directed and acted and the way that I processed the episode, it's like, why am I not rooting for them? Like, why am I sort of, like, why am I on the Roy side? Why am I rolling my eyes at the Pierces and not at the Roys? And I think it's partly out of this sort of, in some senses, the purity of the Roy's presence where, like, they just, like, fuck up that dinner and they're terrible and they're sniping at each other. They just cannot help themselves. But at the very least, they aren't really putting on airs. You know, even in like Connor's stupid politics, like it's, I'm not saying that he's right and I'm not sort of trying to like honor the sort of simplicity of a Trumpian ideal, but like it's at least less adorned in pretension, I guess. Which, you know, I think in a very class conscious world, we're all very attuned to that, you know, well, they think they're better than me or they're putting on airs or whatever, you know, and the Roys for all of their many, many evils don't do that. And the Pierces very much do. I think it's a really interesting way that the show makes us kind of confront that dynamic. But also, I like that the show reminds us that pretty much all very rich people are bad, no matter what side of things they're on.
Absolutely. I mean, like, so you're a theater major and I'm an English major. And like, there are parts of me that like thrill to the idea of like, instead of saying grace, we say a snippet from Richard II or like, you know, whatever it is. Like that's, on the one hand, I love that. And then I also am like, oh, but it's so gross. Oh, but it's so great. At the same time, I have this like really weird relationship with it. And I think that one of the best embodiments of that is when Rhea playing her own part that she plays to sort of curry favor with Nan when, they're talking about Sandy and Stewie's takeover and how it's not real. And Rhea goes, oh, a Potemkin pillage. And they have this like disgusting laugh over that joke. And I'm just like, oh my God. I love it and I hate it. And it's just, it makes me look at myself and feel, bad.
Yeah. Well, I love the way that, you know, Rhea, when we met her last week, she comes in and she's like, you know, she gives the family's official line, which is a hard no. But then, you know, she listens and she appeals to, you know, the Roys in a sort of like collegial level in a sense. But then in this episode, when she's in the presence of the family, it's a totally different ballgame. And she's looking at the Roys as if to be like, I know that I was singing a different tune when we last saw each other, but like, this is how it is now with this situation, you know? I think that's a really well realized, calibration in that character.
That brings us to Connor Roy, surprisingly high on the list because even though he starts, he's paired with, Mark Lynn Baker's character whose first name I can't remember, but he's the political Pierce who works for the Brookings Institution and, Institute. And, he, you know, they sort of clash. I mean, They must have had so much fun writing this episode. But sort of everything that, this Pierce character says, Don Quixote of Iowa tilting at straw poles. Like, yeah. It's just, it's so the worst. It's like NPR weekend, programming bad, but like I listen to NPR weekend programming. So I'm like, I'm here for it. But, but they clash. And then, you know, the morning after, Connor's talking to Frank and he's like, well, I opened a bottle of port and I got tipsy and offered in the State Department. So I actually think I did okay. Connor did his job in the end.
And when they're leaving, when everyone's out in the lawn and the Roys are going to their helicopters, there is like an affectionate kind of back pat that Connor and Marklin Baker do. That's really funny. And I think again, that's an indication of like, I think I was saying this last week about like, you know, Rhea or whoever else gets close to these people, the politics blur. And like, so here are these two guys who are in theory diametrically opposed to one another politically. And yet they had a bottle of port and they were in a big mansion that, you know, they like being in mansions and now, oh, they're like simpatico. And now, you know, like there's some like State Department thing where, so it's like Connor kind of like throwing out his politics too, just because like they're the old boys in the room together, you know? And I think that is all too believable.
Absolutely. All right. Then we have Greg really quickly. We're just going to mention Greg. He's barely in this episode, but he shows up right at the end. And you know, so he gets some points just by dint of like getting to avoid this weekend entirely. Right. So he doesn't have to make any moves. But also the way he comes in, the way he talks to everyone and the way he is always deferential to Marcia is something that I like always notice about Greg and think is interesting and smart of him. So,
you know. Absolutely. I love that. I love that little beat where he's, you know, he asks her how she's doing and you never see anyone ask Marcia how she's doing. Mm-hmm. That's a nice little detail.
Yeah, and something that I think I neglected to mention last week is Sid, when Sid is talking to Greg, she says, you're a smart one, aren't you? We should talk. And like, if Sid Peach thinks you're smart, like, you're smart. So there you go. All right, Roman Roy, the reason he's so low is he's brought low by this announcement about Shiv, whether or not this Shiv thing, survives the episode, which it doesn't seem to, but he does at one point at dinner say like, my life is over, you know, like I didn't know and what the fuck. And,
which
so
is
there's Roman.
Interesting because like, did he really think he was ever going to get it? You know, I find that sort of delusion, kind of curious, but you know, he got his jollies at least after the news.
Absolutely. Once again, and I really like that morning after thing where he's like, where Tom's like, did anyone get up to anything naughty last night? And Roman says exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So, and Jerry responds really well to it. I'm really excited to see how all of that unfolds. I hope it goes on forever.
The late summer's most unexpected romance.
I'm here for it. Hot girl summer. Jerry's having her hot girl summer.
Good for her.
Good times. Good for her. All right. Number 8, Tom. So Tom is in a terrible position this weekend, right? Because, Logan says right off the bat, the same thing to Tom that Tom has often said to Greg, which is like, we're going to kick you around to make ourselves look good.
You have to wear the hair
straw man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to wear the hair shirt. You're the straw man. And Tom's like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. But like, could it be Sid? And he's like, oh, I hear what you're saying, but no. And so Tom, like, you know, he's like, oh, here I am, resident right wing, like ape, and you know, here I am. Oh, I'm so bad. Like all sort of stuff like that. But what's even more scary for Tom is this idea is if like, if Shiv has irrevocably fucked up, which maybe she has, and we will talk about that in a second, he has this line where he's like, I'm not sure how far your father's affection for me extends beyond his affection for you. So if you're out, I am out. And what the fuck?
Well, look how easily he got tossed out of the room, or, you know, metaphorically when they're trying to make the deal. Oh, that's not a problem. She's like, that guy can't run my, and he's like, oh, no, that's fine. And you see Shiv's expression shift a little bit. You know, it just like, yeah, Tom is not, by any means, and maybe never has been secure in that world.
Yeah. So, but I do want to give shout out to Tom for a couple things. One is when he's trying awkwardly to change the conversation at the table and he goes, ah, spinach, king of leaves, like just randomly. And then also when Shiv comes back to the room and she's like, is there any booze? And he goes, no, just Emily Dickinson and low thread, count sheets. Yes. just like so good. So, yeah, so that's Tom on the back foot, which brings us to our loser of the week, which is poor Siobhan. How did Siobhan get here, Richard?
I don't want to say hubris, though maybe there was a little of that. I think it was just the simple mistake of taking her father genuinely. You know, I think that none of these kids or grown kids ever do, but once in a while, they kind of fool themselves into thinking that, you know, and granted, in her defense, when she was offered this, she was like, is this real? Is this real? She asked that like 40 times in the first episode.
Ugh, so many times.
But like, so she knew to doubt. Her instinct was right, of course. But then she let herself get washed, you know, swept away by the fantasy, and she threw her political ambitions out the window, and in so doing, maybe her political principles, blah, blah, blah. And now she finds herself just another sort of victim of Logan's tyrannical vanity.
Yeah, it's like that. You mentioned that expression she gets on her face when Tom is just immediately tossed out. And she like, she has this look like, yep, I will bury everyone for this thing that I want. If I just keep still, maybe I can still get this thing that I really, really want. And for her to say that, I really, really want this to Tom, is a degree of vulnerability I feel like we've never seen from her. And a degree of I want, I guess it's like, it's female ambition, which reads differently than male ambition. And so when we see the like, I want from Roman or from Kendall, you're just sort of like, yeah, of course those boys want their father's company. But to hear his daughter say it, it means something else, unfortunately, in our society. And she plays it so well, you know, it's just it's a real moment when she goes, I really want this, you know?
So. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because you get the feeling, like, what I love is the scene where she comes back to the room with Tom and she's just like shell shocked and she says stuff like, I fucked it or whatever it is, but like she can't believe her own blunder. She's such a political mover. She knows the moves and she just said this thing at the dinner table. Like I don't think she said it without any knowledge of like, this could be a fuck up because like, you know, she's not like self-assured and then he pulls the rug out. She's like awkward and unsure the whole time, you know? And so it's just a fascinating move. It's interesting to rewatch this episode and note that it starts like on her face in the elevator. Yeah. Like watching this episode, knowing it's like the fall of Shiv, if indeed it is the end of Shiv, in this particular arc. So Logan gets what he wants, which is she, you know, he wanted her away from Gil. She was like blackmailing him and all this sort of stuff like that. And he crushed her in the span of like four episodes.
Yeah.
Like so quickly.
And her kind of disbelief about it is a good illustration of the radioactivity of this nexus of power. And it's like it's the ring from Lord of the Rings. The more you wear it or near it, the kind of crazier you go and the more kind of, you know, it's monomaniacal, like, you know, singular ambition you become. And then when it's sort of like snatched away and you come to, you're like, wait, what was I doing? Why was I thinking like that and acting like that? And I think that that's, you know, Shiv having that, it maybe just temporary sort of aha moment of like, oh, it was interesting. I like that a lot.
All right. So before we wrap up, really quickly, what do you want Shiv to do next?
Well, I guess maybe try to like pull the strings from a different angle or pull different strings. Like maybe that means going back into the political arena or whatnot. But like, I don't know if narratively, drama-wise, like, it would be that interesting to see her do more of the vying for the thing that was promised to her. But then again, I have faith that the show can figure out how to do that if that's what they want to do.
I think maybe the reason why her ex departure from Gil was so awkward is to sort of burn that bridge. Like, she can't go back to Gil at this point, right? It seems like.
But she could work for Connor.
I was going to say, maybe she like aligns herself with Sandy and Stewie, who are still trying to do the takeover.
Right.
Or she gets her brother elected president, which is what I think is going to happen. So. Yeah. We'll see. Siobhan could be chief of staff for her brother and like effectively like sort of shadow run the country. Why not? Siobhan, we're rooting for you. We are thrilled to welcome to the Still Watching podcast, an actress who has screen and stage credits a mile long, the incredible J. Smith Cameron, here to talk about her work as the character of Jerry, who's having a very interesting season indeed, had a very interesting time in this episode. So here is J. Smith Cameron to talk about the women of Succession and Jerry and Roman, everyone's favorite new power couple. I know you've already given several interviews about last week's episode in terms of how you reacted when you found out what the nature of Roman and Jerry's relationship, how it was taking. But I'm wondering, you know, when you found out, if you found out at that time it wasn't just going to be one scene, but something of an ongoing, at least multi-episode relationship between them.
I sort of found out on the set of during 201 that there was something coming down the pike between Jerry and Roman. But as to the nature of it, I didn't know specifically, because he has this, you know, the whole idea that he has all these gorgeous girlfriends, but he can't quite, you know, he can't quite carry through. And, you know, he had the sexy male trainer for a while and that came to nothing. And, you know, I don't know if you remember that in season one, he had,
oh yeah,
you know, one-on-one workouts with a sexy, hot, you know, gay guy. I don't know if the trainer was gay, but you know, that was, you know, sort of a frisson between them. You know, I've been around the block on TV shows before, either as leads or supporting characters. You don't take it for granted. It does go on. I don't want to. I mean, you have to be careful about a spoiler. It does. Sure. It does continue to unfold. But again, I don't know. I don't know how they've edited. I mean, we did shoot some other scenes. I don't know what will make the cut. And even, you know, as I've said before, even when the scenes that have made it into 2 and 3 and 4 of this season, I never know which takes they're going to choose. So I always watch it like a little bit with my own jaw dropped, because, you know, we in 205, for instance, that was a particularly crazy scene to navigate. And we did it all kinds of different ways. We did each moment several different ways. There'd be times when I'd be very bossy with him and times when I'd be kind of shy with him or shocked or, you know, and it would change on a dime, like within any one take of the scene. So I thought to myself, I wonder when they're cutting together Jerry's side of this conversation, which take from which pass at the scene they'll use. And that's always the case. But when you have storylines like this one, it really comes into play, where you're like, wow, you could tell a variety of different stories by the different ways we've done each line here, you know? So, I am sitting on the edge of my seat as well.
Right. And so, you know, in episode 5 here, you have an escalation of, what we saw in episode 4 in terms of like, this is, you know, the first time that they are trying out this dynamic in person, even though there winds up being a door between them, you know, there's still more physical closeness than their phone affair. You know, you've known Kieran for so long. What was it like, you know, filming this first scene where you're doing this kind of thing face to face?
You know, he is so, he's such a, facile. And I mean that in the best possible way. He's such a, free, uninhibited actor and doesn't ever judge his character or anybody's character. He's got a really good brain, and he's a really good, really natural, really spontaneous actor, and he can be really accurate about very specific, you know, emotions. And, you know, he doesn't have the same sort of pathos that the Kendall character has so far in the story, or we haven't seen that, but he's totally capable of it. Like, he's a really impressive actor. So yeah. he was very free, but then it's Roman who's sort of driving it. Like, it's Roman who wants to have those interactions. Jerry, we still don't really know how Jerry really feels about it. We know what she says and does, but, and I was always wondering, like, I wonder how Jesse and Mark and Tony and Georgia and all of them, I wonder how they think. We know what she does or what she says, but how is she feeling inside? And they were, I think, kind of open to, for me to solve that for myself. Does that make sense? Like, I might acquiesce with his request in the end, but how do I feel about it? And I think I feel a number of different ways all in a row. So it was really tricky to navigate. And I thought possibly it was more of a question mark for me and my character, maybe, than it was for Kieran, because Kieran is actually initiating it. I mean, not Kieran. Roman he comes looking for that. So he knows what he has to play in the scene. He knows what his intention is. You know, as I thought when I was working on it, why don't I just kick him out? I don't kick him out, but I don't quite approve of it either. So I think the more interesting thing, but infinitely harder to play, is just moment to moment being like, okay, no, that's too far. I don't know, get in the bathroom. You know, it's like, you know, this thinking on the balls of your feet. And it's still amazing to me, like, to find which takes they'll use of these little micro beats.
With Succession, with the amount of, you know, ad lib or different approaches that you are given the freedom to do on the show, I imagine that there are more surprises you would find in the edit, than on a different project, a more rigid project. And, I'm curious, do you recall like a moment of surprise when you're sitting down on Sunday night to watch it for yourself and you're like, oh, they went with that. Okay.
Definitely. All the time. And with, even like scenes, especially, it's really fun because scenes that Jerry's not in, and I read them, and you read the rewrites when they come in. But if you're not on set, or even if you are on set when they're doing it, and you see them do it different ways, it's completely fascinating to find out what is happening. Meanwhile, it's just jammed with interesting psychological facets. And on the one hand, being very cold and objective and pointing out what asses all these characters are. But on the other hand, really letting them being human beings, not judging them too much. Like Tom, for instance, a very sensitive soul in his own horrible way. Or Greg, you know, and certainly can't all of them have these like very extremely vulnerable moments. I mean, Shiv this season has some incredibly, she's always such an unflappable character, Shiv, and she's so vulnerable in this season at times because she's daring to allow herself to think.
Yeah.
You know, there's be ambitious.
There's this moment in this episode, where, you know, before things go completely sideways for her in episode 5, where she just says, like, I really want this to Tom in a mm-hmm. tone of voice. Yeah. I don't think we've heard Sarah use for that character. And it's devastating to watch what happens to her in episode 5.
Oh my God. So, isn't it? Yeah. It's devastating. Yeah. And it's so, that whole scene, do you mean around the table particularly?
Or yeah.
That scene is so cringy and shocking and dangerous. And that is the essence of our show, I think. That sort of overlapping tumble of, you know, horror where all these really powerful people are jockeying for this supremely powerful person to allow them to exist. Like, it's just this shocking, you know, scramble for all these characters to try to stay on the merry-go-round that is Logan Roy's.
One of my favorite comparisons that I saw you make elsewhere is you were talking about sort of the Greek mythological feeling of the story, which is certainly true. And I think you compared Logan to Zeus and maybe Marcia to Hera or something like that. Zeus and Hera. But I'm curious if there's Zeus and Hera, where does a Jerry fit in? Like, who is Jerry in that sort of Greek mythological world?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say she is an Athena type, but so is Shiv. So, I would say, that she's kind of a thinker and a soldier, you know, a warrior in a way. But I don't know specifically how it would break down. But I love that. I mean, I like that analogy of them being Greek gods and goddesses because the Greek gods and goddesses are so horrible. They all have terrible downsides to their nature.
Yeah.
Like they're not better. They don't transcend human nature. They magnify it. It's like they each have some sliver of human nature that's horrible just to an egregious extent. And they sort of glorify it. So that's the nature of our show. It glorifies these like powerful people with these horrible failings. Not glorify them, like, I don't think that for one minute you ever get the feeling that the show celebrates who they are. Rather, have fun exposing how awful they are. I mean, I think it definitely has that taste to it, but it's really like you see these characters just, you know, revel in revealing their horribleness in an unchecked way, you know? And there's something, I think cathartic about watching that because it's so awful in real life when powerful people exploit their power. So it's fun to watch these powerful people try and fail or flounder. Don't you think? I mean, I think that's part of the success of this.
We like calling it hate watching the rich.
Hate watching.
Call it.
Right.
But also, as you say, like, then you find yourself feeling for a Kendall or a Tom and you're surprised to find yourself having any tenderness for them since they're such monsters sometimes. So it's interesting.
I know.
I'm curious, you know, given your history in the theater, are you the kind of performer who likes to, develop a full, you know, sort of background story, history for your characters?
I sure am, but this one is a real challenge because any TV show is like that, really, because you can be, you know, on a show for four seasons and then halfway through the fourth season find out that there's something in her past that they decided to write in that you had no idea, you know. So you have to have kind of sea legs to be in a TV show. So you do that homework, but you have to be willing to be like, oh, okay, strike that. Now we know this about Jerry, or now we know this about Roman, or now we know that, you know. And I think that's it's particularly true for supporting characters because we do, in the end, have to kind of serve the storyline in a different way. Like we're kind of there to, you know, a lot of my work on the show is exposition, frankly, like just explaining what we're up against as a corporation. You know, when I first had this job, it was sort of, I wasn't a regular character. I had a sort of mini contract to be in to be in episodes 102 through 106 through the attempted coup in season one. And possibly she might be needed in 9 and 10 if she's available kind of thing. And then they kept writing me in, but I think that was because they didn't know whether Jerry was one of the people going to be fired at the end of the coup.
Well, I'm wondering if you can share, I mean, knowing that it might change based on what the writers decide, if you can share what your story is in your head of how Jerry got involved in Waystar Royko in the first place, like how long she's known Logan, how that all started.
I think just roughly, I think she's worked for decades for him and worked her way up to general counsel. And then she's a widow. And in 102, I talk about how my husband, whose name was Baird, I believe, who was along with me godparents to Shiv, I thought to myself that maybe my husband, who perhaps was older than me, was maybe more of an age with Logan, was a more senior executive, and that as his wife, I kind of, like how that often is in politics, like when a senator passes away or something and the wife kind of takes on some of their duties. I felt like maybe she was a lawyer on the staff and worked her way up, and that there was maybe a big shift when he died. I remember when I usually wear my own wedding ring in shows, and I thought, oh, I can just wear my ring. So I just kept my ring on the first day, and they came running up to me and they're like, you have to take your wedding ring off. And then you can, like a lot of people who've been married a long time, but you can kind of see, even with my rings off, you can kind of see where it usually lives. It's like kind of a knot right. there. So they had to bring me like a big chunky, a little dent, right? So I, especially if it's right away, like if you don't have time for the, you know, for your finger to kind of bounce back. So they ran and brought me like a chunky cocktail ring to hide that line. And then that became a signature thing when there was more Jerry and more, that's one thing that kind of changed from season one to season two is Michelle and Matlin and I began to think of Jerry not so much as just always in the work uniform, the Brooks Brothers, you know, off the rack, but lovely, you know, but off the rack kind of go-to corporate outfit. But now, like in season two, I have much more fashionable, I have different, there's more moods to Jerry's wardrobe and then this year I have like a little wardrobe of chunky cocktail rings, and that's sort of fun to sort of watch the costume plot of Jerry's jewelry.
I love that. Yeah. I'm going to start tracking those rings. You said that you're not sure, that Jerry is just sort of like living moment to moment with this Roman thing and trying to figure out how she feels about it in the moment. But more broadly speaking, what do you think Jerry wants more broadly speaking, like career wise, anything wise? And then, you know, what do you want for her, as an actress?
Well, that is a really good question. Like the rest of the pack, I think Jerry would like to figure into the succession. But I think more than the others, I think she is a realist who really sees not only that that Logan is not going to go gently into that good night. You know what I mean? She's not going to give up the reins of power without a fight. And I don't think she would think to fight him. So I think I'm not sure. I just think she's too crafty for that. But that's her main skill is that she's very good at reading that. And I think she also, I mean, by my observation from my dialogue in the past, I think she really gets that Logan's business moves are often outrageous and shouldn't work. But by the force of nature that he is, and by his track record, crazy ideas he has sometimes work because businessmen have come to, and banks have come to have confidence in him because his track record. So crazy things like the Pierce acquisition, I know on paper that there's no way that should work. But I think when push comes to shove, Jerry has the sense to go like, well, but if you look at the big long term, you know, that the kids are always thinking that he's not up to speed with modern times and what he wants to invest with, and that he's always doing, you know, buying local news channels and not thinking digitally and so forth and so forth. But, you know, I think Jerry sees that, well, say what you will, if you look at his track record, he's got this uniquely successful trajectory. And like the banks, I think she kind of continues to bet on him. And with the exception at the beginning of season one, when we thought when he had his stroke and we didn't know if he was of sound mind. And that continues to be somewhat of a question mark because he is so volatile and he has such crazy ambitions that he's a little bit King Lear-ish and we don't know how mad he is. Right.
But right. Yeah.
Right. But within that, of the characters, I think Jerry is like of the school of thought, well, you got to hand it to him. Like, he's got some crazy ideas, but he's the one person on earth to pull them off if anyone can. So even though she might have her own agenda, I think she's smart enough to know which horse to bet on in that group. And, you know, up until quite recently, I personally, me as an actor, I didn't really indulge in thinking of her future that much because, as I said, I started out doing 4 episodes. And then about this time when they picked up the show for season 2 and made me a regular, then I was like, oh, that's nice. But I didn't really, I didn't actually have any sense of to project how involved I'd be. So I do think she's ambitious, but she's too crafty to want to inherit the company when it's on shaky ground, when it's in the middle of a takeover, when it's in debt, I think she's, and also, you know, I think she's already a huge success. She makes a ton of money and she's very influential. So I think she's also been around long enough to know, you know, that there's the power behind the throne is very powerful. So, whereas the throne itself is very vulnerable. So I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question and one I haven't totally answered for myself. But I do think that, I mean, one way the Roman Jerry alliance could play out is that suddenly their ambitions are more credible because together they're...
Everyone needs a support person in this particular battle, it feels like. You know, if you're operating alone, I'm worried for you in succession. So, yeah.
And Tendall doesn't, Tendall and Shiv do not, they have enough hubris to not think they need support from the others, you know? And I think Roman is maybe smarter than people have given him credit to be, you know, he's clever, but maybe he's actually wiser than we've given him credit, or he's becoming wise sort of as the season unfolds. He's kind of wising up, or I think he is.
I know that you, when you auditioned, the character was originally sketched out to be male, G-E-R-R-Y versus G-E-R-R-I. Other than that last vowel changing, how was the character changed from when you auditioned to when you were playing it as female? Or was it just left the same and then left up to you to sort of put your spin on it?
First of all, I think when I auditioned, they hadn't really written Jerry yet, that they had known that there was a general counsel and that I feel like they knew there was going to be a Frank and they knew there was going to be a Jerry and they knew there was going to be a Carl and they didn't really know about, you know, that they knew there'd be other characters like that too, but they didn't know who was who because in my audition sides, there were some lines that ended up being Frank's. So I think they were beginning to craft that about the time I got cast. And I think, you know, it's to their credit that it dawned on them. That, I mean, a lot of these big conglomerates do have female general counsels. So I think they thought, oh, that's a great opportunity to hire a woman. I think that was clever on their part. And I think that's also an interesting thing about these women who have these high positions in business is they have to be they have to have a lot of guts and, so I think that there is a little bit of being able to be one of the guys anyway at work kind of,
right.
You know, there was a lot in season 1 of people, those brothers, not just the brothers, all the guys just have this potty mouth and Jerry just rolls her eyes. Like she doesn't, you know, she can take it. So I think that really not that much. I think that I don't know that it was that it changed hugely in the way they wrote it because at that point we didn't see anything of her personal life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So little things like we have the little interesting things come up where when we were going to see inside Jerry's apartment, just right. What would her decor be like? And they were very interested in my two cents about that. So I thought to myself, I think she is at work all the time, but she has a lot of money. I think she has an apartment that's designed entirely within an inch of its life by someone with really good taste. And if somebody comes in and cleans every day, just like a hotel almost. That, you know, she probably has downsized in terms of space from wherever she lived with her husband when she was married. And I remember having, you know, thoughts about, you know, I mean, in the past when I've had thoughts about her backstory, occasionally Jesse will be like, that's interesting. Let's put a pin in it. Let's don't put too fine a point. Let's not make up our mind about this or that yet, because it gives us more elbow room. So I think that, you know, it's a evolving project, who she is. Yeah. It makes it really fun. It's just stressful for me.
Yeah. And then my last question is, when I was first recommending the show in season one to people, a barrier of entry for some people was, you know, they thought, oh, this is just another show about rich white men behaving badly, like emphasis on the men. You know, I don't know that I'm interested in that. And then I was making the case for what I thought were incredibly interesting and complex female characters in the show. And, you know, you've got even more opportunity in this season with the addition of like Holly and Cherry and all this, these great actresses coming in and chewing up, these roles. But then you also have a number of women in the writer's room, which I think just makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
To what we see on screen.
Pretty much 50-50.
Which is incredible. So I was just wondering if you could talk about sort of, the value of having those incredibly intelligent women in the Succession writer's room, and then what it's been like to have even more women to play with in season two.
Oh, well, it's fantastic, obviously. And I think, you know, I think one of the defining qualities of the show, of what it's about, is I think it skewers the patriarchy very deliberately. Like, it shows these kind of really bloated egos of these powerful men. And then it shows these extremely deft, crafty women, making very careful but decisive steps forward. So, I mean, I think it's maybe, in the grand scheme of things, a big unfolding plot of its own. I can't imagine. I don't know. I have no idea what the big overall story is going to be. And I'm sincere about that. I really don't know. I don't want to know. What the big overarching story will be. But I think it seems to me as if it's very deliberately like you do see these like brilliant female characters kind of steadfastly pressing through the bullshit, like in a stealthy kind of way. Like, you know, even Marsha is very, you know, she's not a business person in the story, but she is very, she handles her side of things very carefully and very cunningly, in an impressive way. And there's, I don't know of a single, I mean, I guess Willa is sort of a celebrity gibbet, but certainly Tabitha, his, Roman's girlfriend, you know, Holly's character, Cherry's character, totally Sarah's character. They're all so fierce and so intelligent. They're much more impressive. I mean, the guys are the ones that are really fucked up, you know? So it's real. I mean, I feel like if you look carefully, it's very much the opposite of being about, I mean, it is about them throwing their weight around, the men, but it's, they're not totally successfully throwing their weight around.
I love, you know, that. And yeah. And I kind of want the phrase steadfastly pressing through the bullshit, like on a t-shirt or an inspirational poster. for myself.
Hey, that's a great idea.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for this great
performance. Oh, I really enjoyed this. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. All right. So that is it for us this week. We'll be back with episode 6, which I don't even know the title of yet. Until we return, Richard, where can people find you?
Oh, probably just tidying up one of the 17 bedrooms in my weird little house. and I'll be tweeting at Ryla's and writing for VF.com. Joanna, where will you be until next week?
I'll be mixing myself I believe it's called a brake bumper, which I stole from Teddy Roosevelt's valet's wallet, the recipe for. So cheers to that. Or you can find me on VanityFair.com or tweeting at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you next time.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.